We have been requesting and receiving many wonderful writings about Mother in order to mark the 20th anniversary of her Mahasamadhi. And it's interesting when we receive how varied the responses are, and some are long and some are short, and each one has a character of its own author. I thought I would read to you one that Lois wrote recently. It begins, "When given the task of writing a few words on Mother's behalf, it became overwhelming. How can one understand the idea of air and then comment on it? How do you explain that? How do you take something that is so outside the physical realm and then write about it on the physical plane? My experiences with Mother are so very personal that written words cannot express it adequately, which means I am at a loss. The best I can do is to simply say, Mother pulled me into her path, and that path became my path, and that path became other people's path. So here we are, all going down the same path, looking for our destiny, our own goal. How hard we look will determine how soon we arrive. What God and Mother has shown me is that the path is not Master's path, it is all God." And I think that's wonderful. And it's so very true, trying to describe the air that we breathe. Papa wrote, "Guru is a spiritual guide. He is the enlightener of the aspirant's intellect. He transforms consciousness of the aspirant and turns it from the world to God. As the word itself connotes, he is a giver of light. By the contact of such a one alone, the soul is awakened to the reality of God. Truly, he is the redeemer and savior of those who are immersed in ignorance. So it is essential that the aspirant should receive illumination from the guru." Reading from the book by Khalil Gibran, Jesus, the Son of Man, Mary Magdalene. And this is the perspective, as Gibran writes about it, from Mary Magdalene's perspective. "It was in the month of June when I saw him for the first time. He was walking in the wheat field when I passed by with my handmaidens, and he was alone. The rhythm of his step was different from other men's, and the movement of his body was like naught I had seen before. Men do not pace the earth in that manner, and even now I do not know whether he walked fast or slow. My handmaidens pointed their fingers at him and spoke in shy whispers to one another, and I stayed my steps for a moment and raised my hand to hail him. But he did not turn his face, and he did not look at me, and I hated him. I was swept back into myself, and I was as cold as if I had been in a snowdrift, and I shivered. That night I beheld him in my dreaming. And they told me afterward that I screamed in my sleep and was restless upon my bed. It was in the month of August that I saw him again, through my window. He was sitting in the shadow of a cypress tree across my garden, and he was still as if he had been carved out of stone, like the statues in Antioch and other cities of the north country. And my slave, the Egyptian, came to me and said, 'That man is here again. He is sitting there across your garden.' And I gazed at him, and my soul quivered within me, for he was beautiful. His body was single, and every part seemed to love every other part. Then I clothed myself with the raiment of Damascus, and I left my house and walked towards him. Was it my aloneness, or was it his fragrance that drew me to him? Was it a hunger in my eyes that desired comeliness? Or was it his beauty that sought the light of my eyes? Even now I do not know. I walked to him with my scented garments and my golden sandals, the sandals the Roman captain had given to me, even these sandals. And when I reached him, I said, "Good morrow to you." And he said, "Good morrow to you, Miriam." And he looked at me, and his night eyes saw me as no man had seen me. And suddenly I was as if naked, and I was shy. Yet he had only said, "Good morrow to you." And then I said to him, "Will you not come to my house?" And he said, "Am I not already in your house?" I did not know what he meant then, but I know now. And I said, "Will you not have wine and bread with me?" And he said, "Yes, Miriam, but not now." "Not now, not now," he said. And the voice of the sea was in those two words, and the voice of the wind and the trees. And when he said them unto me, life spoke to death. For mind you, my friend, I was dead. I was a woman who had divorced her soul. I was living apart from this self which you now see. I belonged to all men and to none. They called me a harlot and a woman possessed of seven devils. I was cursed and I was envied. But when his dawn eyes looked upon my into my eyes, all the stars of my night faded away, and I became Miriam, only Miriam, a woman lost to the earth she had known, and finding herself in new places. And now again I said to him, "Come into my house and share bread and wine with me." And he said, "Why do you bid me to be your guest?" And I said, "I beg you to come into my house." And it was all that was sod in me, all that was sky in me, calling unto him. Then he looked at me, and the noontide of his eyes was upon me. And he said, "You have many lovers, and yet I alone love you. Other men love themselves in your nearness. I love you in yourself. Other men see a beauty in you that shall fade away sooner than their own years. But I see in you a beauty that shall not fade away, and in the autumn of your days the beauty shall not be afraid to gaze at itself in the mirror, and it shall not be offended. I alone love the unseen in you." Then he said in a low voice, "Go away now. If this cypress tree is yours, and you would not have me sit in its shadow, I will walk my way." And I cried to him, and I said, "Master, come to my house. I have incense to burn for you, and a silver basin for your feet. You are a stranger, and yet not a stranger. I entreat you, come to my house." And he stood up and looked at me, even as the seasons might look down upon the field. And he smiled. And he said again, "All men love you for themselves. I love you for yourself." And then he walked away. But no other man ever walked the way he walked. Was it a breath born in my garden that moved to the east? Or was it a storm that would shake all things to their foundations? I knew not. But on that day the sunset of his eyes slew the dragon in me, and I became a woman. I became Miriam, Miriam of Mijdad. And another reading from Master, his commentary on the Bhagavad Gita, chapter 18, verse 55 and 6. By that supreme devotion, he realizes me and my nature, what and who I am. After knowing these truths, he quickly makes his entry into me. Over and above, performing faithfully all one's duties, taking shelter in me, it is my pleasure a devotee obtains the eternal, unchangeable state. Master's commentary, the devotee beholds God as the shelter of all creatures, and himself as the unsheltered by any other power. Without attachment to the fruits of his efforts, he continuously engages in God-united yoga activities and all other divinely obligatory duties just to please God. After meeting all the requirements of the laws of liberation, the yogi ultimately finds, by the freely given grace of God, by my pleasure, the eternal state of liberation. The quality of a yogi's realization and other actions, the guru's help, and God's grace, these are the three requisites of liberation. The quality of a yogi's meditation and other actions, the guru's help, and God's grace, these are the three requisites of liberation. No matter how much a devotee strives for salvation, and he is required to make the effort wholeheartedly for God, that effort constitutes only 25% of the requirements for liberation. Another 25% depends on his guru's blessing, spiritually stimulating the disciple's striving. But the guru's help and the devotee's effort notwithstanding, it is necessary to have also God's grace, which may be said to constitute the remaining 50% of the requirements. God the creator of the cosmic law of karma that binds human life is the sole judge as to whether a devotee has fulfilled all the laws of spiritual conduct required for liberation. However, a devotee who, with the help of his guru, fulfills all the laws and then instantly expects immediate liberation will not find it. God is not a mathematical produced jackpot. Isn't that wonderful? God is not a mathematically produced jackpot. But if the devotee fulfills the divine laws and also has complete love for God, taking shelter in me, that all-surrendering love draws his grace. Man is made in the image of God's love, and by manifesting unconditional love, he can again become like the Father, merging in him and dropping his acquired second nature as a mortal being. These are wonderful truths. And from a human's perspective, sometimes we find it difficult to comprehend everything that's contained within the concept of the guru. It's been an interesting journey on my own part, as coming to Mother in a state of ignorance and of separation, having an ill-defined yearning in my heart, a pain in my soul that I yearn to have replaced with bliss. I was also in a state of ignorance, not knowing, and I yearned with all of my heart, soul, and mind to know the truth. And I felt that these two requirements, to have bliss and to know the truth, were the things that drove me in my sadhana. It was when I met Mother that I felt the charge of spiritual power and the intelligence that she conveyed through her teachings, that I felt that this was someone who could guide me to the divine portal. I didn't know it with my complete being. I was a doubter. I was a skeptic. There were parts of me that knew and other parts that did not know. And it was to be several years before I really could fully, with 100% of myself, put myself onto that path. My mind would go back and forth. I would think, well, what if this isn't true? I hadn't experienced the fullness of the truth as of yet, so how could I say for certain that it was true? And of course, I couldn't say. I wasn't willing to be an echo chamber for somebody else's words and feel the hollowness of that echo going further and further. That was not satisfying to me and did not fulfill my requirements. I needed more. I needed some kind of inner assurance, and I wasn't receiving it. I was getting experiences, But those experiences itself did not heal the gulf of ignorance that still enshrouded me. And so it was at some point, about 2 years after my mother, that I went through a reasoning process. And I thought, all right, what if this path that I'm following and mother that I'm following it through, what if it all turns out to be a hoax? What if it all turns out to be a lie, not true? Perhaps I die and I find out that the Orthodox Christians are right and I'm sentenced to the hot spot down below because I didn't believe just in quite the right way. I thought, well, that's a heavy penalty. However, do I feel like I am following the highest light that I know? Do I feel like, with all earnestness of mind, heart, and soul, that I am pursuing the best and highest truth that I think will take me to God's feet? And without any hesitation, I knew the answer was yes. There was no higher path that I could entertain. There is nothing that had called to me in the way that this path and mother had. And so it was at that point I could put aside, even if I was completely wrong, I would not regret one moment, one bit of effort that I had put into realizing the truth. And it was then that I took myself out of having one foot in and one foot out, always guarding myself, always trying to hedge my bets. I understand that in the stock market there are people who will buy stocks in such a way that if they rise, they will make some money, and if they go down, they will make some money. It's amazing to me that people can do it in that way, but apparently they can. They don't make as much or lose as much, but they're hedging their bets, whether it goes up or down. The spiritual path requires that we not hedge our bets, ultimately, because it requires our wholehearted effort into realizing God. And so as the years went by, slowly, gradually, the truth came. And it came in such a way that it silenced the doubting Thomas inside of me. The bliss came. So much of my early sadhana days were filled with pain, filled with that separation. There is nothing wrong with this body or this life in an outer sense that made it filled with pain. It was a pure soul pain. No one could see it, perhaps, but I was immersed in it. And I yearned only for liberation. I yearned only for bliss. But the fact was is that because of my back and forth attitude, I delayed the day when I would be able to step through that portal into the kingdom of heaven. It was my own doubt. It was my own ignorance. It was my own karma from the past that acted as roadblocks. The divine was ever within me. In fact, it was the power of God that was awakening himself within me. Truth be told, if it were up to my own ego, I would have just as soon lived a more lackadaisical life, one in which I just kind of went along with society and the norms of society and hoped to get some happiness in that way. But that wasn't to be. It felt as if God had cruelly picked me out of the line and pulled me into some kind of inner torture chamber that I could not be released from. And for many years, I felt that this was a disservice to me. But as I grew in my realization of my oneness with God, I began to see it as a blessing and not as a curse. And isn't this the truth in so many ways of our life? But it required my whole being, my whole heart. I was talking to an individual up in Canada who had come from a different spiritual path. They had their own guru, and their own guru had taught them that attaining God was very much like mathematics. They used that terminology. And that if she performed these certain rites and these certain ceremonies, then she would mathematically be drawn to God. In fact, Master talks a bit like that himself in the autobiography and other places about Kriya Yoga. And yet here he says it's not like mathematics. And so she was telling me about her path and how she dedicated herself to meditation so many hours a day, and she is very dedicated. Every day was a trial. Every day was sitting there performing her rites without getting the results. And what God showed to me was that she was operating from her intellect, but not from her heart. And that if she was to make true progress, she would have to do it with devotion, not just purely as a mathematical formula. That your whole heart and soul has to be dedicated to your path. And as I spoke to her about that, tears started to stream down her eyes, and she admitted that she had held that back, that she had many painful experiences from the past. And she wasn't confident that she could open those up. And she just wanted liberation without having to pay the price, so to speak. And so through our talk, she determined that that was a necessary ingredient now. And so devotion is absolutely an important part. Now, some people hear the word devotion and they think of sentimentality, that they have to have tears all the time or wear their emotions on their sleeve. And that's not it at all. To be in a bhakti state. Bhakti means love and devotion. In our own spiritual path, what it means is that we are 100% on the path. Heart, mind, and soul. We don't hold any part of ourselves back. And then when this great spiritual revolution begins within our being, we don't hold back. We don't step back from it. Many people have an initial experience in powerful inner experiences. Sometimes it is the awakening of the Kundalini. And they step back because they think that they are ill-prepared. They're not sure where this will take them. They're not sure that they'll be all right. And so they cut the experience off, which you can do. You can take yourself out of the stream of consciousness that takes you into the heights. And anybody who has been practicing their path for some time and not getting the results, I can guarantee you, you are holding back. You are not giving yourself heart, mind, and soul. And you are doing it out of fear. Fear, ultimately, is the ultimate separation between ourselves and God. Without fear, there would be no boundaries. There would be no walls. There would be only oneness. Because that love would sweep in and replace all fear. A life without fear is not emptiness. You know, it's an interesting thing how we can get involved in a negative pattern. And even though it produces us pain, and we complain about it, and we don't like it, we hang on to it. I know in my own case that fear, I did not think of myself as a fearful person when I started the path, but believe me, I encountered fear along the way. And it came up inside of me, and it was fierce. When I sat down for meditation, I wanted to be anywhere except sitting on the meditation blanket. And so I had to encounter it. I had to keep myself on the field. I knew that somehow, that if I didn't keep myself there, that I would never overcome it. And it lasted for years. It wasn't just a once type of thing. It's something that came up. Where did it come from? It came from all the different experiences I have had as a soul in my outward journey from God. And I had to face every one of them. But you know, once they're faced and they're overcome, you don't have to live with that fear any longer. Now love comes in and replaces fear. Love recognizes itself within itself and within all beings. Love is the substratum out of which all of this creation has come into being. It is an act of love and joy. Now we only have to open our eyes and look around us to see how far we have come from that initial promulgation of this universe. And yet, there it is. If we look at what all the saints and realized masters around the world, all the different scriptures, they all say the same thing. This universe is an explosion of joy and light and love. And when we are identified with our spirit, we know this to be true. You know it to be true within your entire being. And there is times when it was difficult for me to be with my guru, because of various things that she went through. Sometimes it was the load that she was carrying. And because the load that she was carrying was filled with negativity and darkness, not that she was negativity and darkness, but she carried it. And as a result of that, that's what I experienced in myself, in my empathy for her. And so it could be a field of darkness that I wanted to step out of, step away from. It's natural. It's human. And yet this is exactly the wrong thing to do. Master, when he met Sri Yukteswar, Sri Yukteswar exacted a promise from him. The first promise was that Sri Yukteswar would love Master unconditionally. And would Master promise to do the same? And as an outcropping of that, Sri Yukteswar said, I want you to promise me you will never avoid me. Well, Master promised that, maybe not fully suspecting exactly all the implications that that would carry with it. Master was a young man at the time. He was, of course, a tremendous soul. He is a magnet for many others. He's a natural leader. And when at university, he would talk to his classmates about his divine guru. All the experiences that he was having were fresh with him, and he was full of enthusiasm. And so he would bring his friends and all those who were interested to see Sri Yukteswar. Well, they would sit down, and suddenly Sri Yukteswar would just be criticizing Master up one side and down the other. Why don't you do this, and why are you doing that, and you need to be doing that? And he was humiliated in front of his friends. He was kind of thinking, well, I'm kind of getting to be a spiritually realized being here, and my master should be, you know, maybe exalting me a little bit. And here he is, completely tearing me down. And can you imagine? Put yourself in his footsteps. Sitting there and receiving that kind of rebuke. And it was tough. It was tough. And many of his friends didn't stay. Perhaps they were thinking, well, I could be the target of that the next time. I'm not sure I want that. So they stayed away from him. They didn't see in his master what Master saw in Sri Yukteswar. And that is one of the great mysteries in life. Jesus said it in that one would be taken up at that time. Two would be working in the field, and one would be taken up and the other would be left. In a household, there would be many, and one would be taken up and the rest left behind. It's a mysterious process. He said, many are called, but few are chosen. So there is that portion of us that chooses, but there is also another portion of what God chooses to reveal to the individual. Is there a calling? Is there a calling? I'm really loath to try to talk people to coming on this path, because I know how hard it is. And if you don't have an internal fire, if you don't have an internal drive that puts you on the path and keeps you there, you're not likely to get much success in it. It has to be a calling. It has to be an internal fire and drive that's so powerful that it drives you through all the obstacles, all the different forces. The guru is so powerful because it is the human and the divine that is combined into one. Mother oftentimes said, I am totally human and totally divine. She had both. and her divinity manifested through her humanity. And yet it was a humanness. I think for many people who are perhaps Christians or those who worship Krishna or others who exist at a much later date, or even Master as it stands today through the organization, it is easy to idealize the Master, not to see the humanity within the Master, not be confronted with that. Ramana Maharshi one night was moaning in his sleep. And the next day, they created some doubt in one of the aspirants who was around him. He heard him moaning in his sleep because he was in pain. And he said, "Master, if you are not the body, then why were you moaning?" And the Master said, "It's just the body. It's just what it does when it's in pain. I let it do what it wants to do." You see, a Master doesn't put a false front on. There's no need to. That's the human ego, who feels like it has to build itself up or has to be in the world in a particular way. And Mother was completely at ease with herself. She saw the divinity manifesting through the humanity. But it's not always easy for the disciples around because they see the humanness. They see the different aspects that come forward, and it can act as a blinding screen that keeps us from intuiting the divine behind the veil. I've told the story before, but I think it's such a powerful experience in my own life. Of when I went to see Mother, and she was in the Arden nursing homes because she was needing 24-hour nursing care. She had had the shingles, she had strokes, she had heart attacks. She was really in tough shape. Half of her life was paralyzed, half of her body was paralyzed from the stroke. The other side was infected with the shingles. And so it was really a difficult time for her. And I walked into the nursing home, and as the case with many nursing homes, it was all right by nursing home standards. But it's difficult. There are people with dementia, and they're crying out, and there's other people who are sitting in the hallways looking very vacant. It's almost like walking into one of Dante's infernos. And you think, oh my God, I'd rather do anything than be in one of these places. And the smells are all not that wonderful, and everything that goes with it. And so I'm walking through these hallways and finally come to Mother's room, and there she is, who in the past had been the most powerful human being I had ever met in my life. She exuded such spiritual power, such beauty on a human level and on a divine level. And here she was sitting in a wheelchair. She was slumped over. She had no use of one half of her body, so her arm was hanging limp. Her mouth on one side was drooping down, and there was a little bit of drool coming out of it. I paint a vivid picture because I want you to encounter the humanity of it, as I did. I wasn't sure whether she recognized. We had a conversation. I wasn't sure she knew who I was. I thought that she did, but I wasn't positive. And whether she would even know it 5 minutes after I had left. And I was shaken, I can tell you. This most powerful person I'd ever met. What has happened? And I didn't know. All I knew was that I was very shaken. And so I went home. I sat down on the meditation blanket. I asked God, "What is this? What has happened? What is this all about?" And I sat there for a very long time. And I meditated. I opened myself to the ajna and to what God had to give to me. And after a long time, a tremendous vision came to me. And I saw in my ajna the tremendous light, and it was Mother, and it was her form, but the light was so powerful that the form was just a small part of it. The light was the greater part of it. It was a pure white light. And within my peripheral vision, I looked as far as I could, from the left to the right, up and below, and the light extended in every direction. And she was beautiful, beautiful, such a spiritual being and light. And Mother, through thought transference, said to me, "Do you not know I am in my light body?" And with that experience, all the heaviness, all the doubt, everything dropped from me. And I never again mistook who Mother was for the body that she inhabited. I felt sympathy for the body, and I learned so much through her experiences in this way. I knew through my own personality that if I encountered such tremendous difficulty as she did, that I would have shirked from it. I would have wanted to just run away, and I never saw her do that. She confronted it. She was determined to overcome it. She had every reason to feel down, doubt, and despair. I never saw it once. She would tell you exactly what she was feeling, sometimes uncomfortably so. The pain that she was in, the difficulty that she was going through, she never shirked from any of it. But there is an important ingredient added to that, because she would always bring it back to God. Her demand upon God that this body should operate again in the way that it did, that she should have her memory, that she should have everything as she once had it. And she was absolutely determined. And she never let go of that. She never let go of life. And it was a powerful lesson that imprinted itself upon my brain. And I hope to God that is one that took, that stays there, and is always there. That reaching out for life, that reaching out for the light, never letting go of that, and even if we should kick the frame of this body, but we're holding on to that desire for light and life. You see how that actuates the mind and attunes it with the highest consciousness. Now, there may come a time when we recognize that this is the time to give up this body. That's different. Because then we're expanding and reaching out. We're letting go of this body, but we're reaching out for the light. But as long as God inspires you to, you reach out for more life, not less. It's a great misnomer in this world that people have that somehow in attaining God consciousness, you become less connected to life. It's a very strange turn of events that the human ego does. The reality is you are going to the very source of life, the source of your life, everything that you have, everything that you call your own has come from that source. And the human ego has hijacked that life energy and that intelligence and pats itself on the back and says, "My, how well I have done." Or how badly have I done? Either are the same side of the same coin, two sides of the same coin. So reach out for life. Reach out for light. This is what the Master has come to teach us, to be the example for us. I know within my own experience how that divine life has grown. And the human life is still there, the human body is still there, but it recedes into the background as the divine life grows. And then comes the experience where there is only divine life. And then in order to enjoy the play and to be a part of the human experience, there is an experience of the humanity, but only as an expression of the divinity, even as a hand and a glove. The glove is the body, the hand is God. And it is the hand that animates the glove. Take away the hand and the glove is an empty suit. There's nothing to it. And so we learn to attune ourselves to the Master, to the Guru. The Guru comes and we form so many different relationships. I never felt, as some did, that Mother was my friend in that sense. She never allowed it. If I tried to approach her in that way, she put her arm out and she held me at a distance. I also never felt I could know Mother entirely. There is always the larger part of her that felt mysteriously beyond my own vision. And sometimes that is disconcerting to people. You know, it's the human mind's capacity and tendency towards putting parameters around any kind of an experience. You put it into a box, you put a label on the box, you put it up on the shelf, and you say, I know what that is, and you feel quite pleased with yourself. The guru-disciple relationship is not like that. The guru-disciple relationship is intended to take you beyond yourself. Therefore, you must surrender yourself, not as a weak person to a strong person, but in acknowledgement and recognition of the divine nature that is actively manifest in the guru. And when you do that, you attune yourself to that divine nature. You encounter the humanity and you recognize where your own humanity bumps up against its own limits. And then you surrender that because you know intuitively that it is the divine that manifests through the human. This is the great value that the guru-disciple relationship places on us. And it is the greatest gift that can possibly be given to us. I cannot think of any single relationship, any other experience that even comes close to the value that I know that Mother has played and continues to play in my life. All life is eternal. But the life of the guru truly is because they have realized that eternal nature within themselves. Therefore, they can actively manifest it as one who has not fully realized it cannot. And so Mother's active grace is very much alive and well. I receive hundreds of reports about Mother's influence in various people's lives in a way that changes them, uplifts them, transforms them. And it is beautiful, and it is wonderful, and it is everything that we should learn to treasure and to keep deep in our heart, in our mind, in our soul. There is no way that in a single talk I could express all the variants, all the benefits, all of the challenges, everything the guru-disciple relationship brings. It is not possible. Because human variabilities, Lari Mahasaya had the wonderful saying that man's ingenuity seems to be endless in getting himself into trouble. Fortunately, God's ingenuity is even more at getting us out of the trouble. And so our ways of getting ourselves into trouble seem to be endless many times. But gurus and God's grace are up to the challenge if we put ourselves wholeheartedly at the feet of God and guru. It is a surrender that is done in wisdom and with full knowledge and does not make us weaker, but makes us by far stronger, more capable. Even Jesus, recognizing John the Baptist as his previous guru, even though he had risen up spiritually superior, more powerful, acknowledged that relationship, acknowledged that he should be baptized by his guru. Such love, such wisdom, such an example for all the ages. When you delve deeply into guru-disciple relationship, you will come into contact with your own divinity. And then it is all explained, all shown to you. All doubts become resolved. and you come into your own state of illumination. Be it so. Be it so now. Be it so every day. Be it so always. You will pray with me. O Heavenly Father. Divine Mother.
Divine Mother.
I feel the wonder and the beauty.
Of thy glorious presence.
In every part of my being.
My heart is bursting with my love for thee.
I kneel in adoration at thy feet. And surrender myself to thee. I feel the power of thy perfection.
Surging in every cell of my body.
My mind and my intelligence. Are radiant with thy healing light. My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss.
Of my communion with thee.
I and my Father are one. Blessed Spirit, I am He. Peace. Bliss.